Chapter 78. Germany alone is guilty. The Allies could not agree on a figure covering all reparations. The American delegation had become skeptical of the astronomical amounts claimed by Tardieu and his associates, but it did nothing to lower them. Instead, it decided not to specify a figure and left this task to a commission called the Permanent Conference for Reparations. This commission was a garbage can for failed agreements and negotiations. Its official and high-sounding name was meant to give the impression that problems were being solved. In fact, it was a way for cowardly politicians to place the implementation of the Versailles Treaty into the hands of faceless bureaucrats. The conference was given a blank check on which to write whatever figure it deemed appropriate. The treaty stated, "The treaty determines the damages Germany must pay without saying how much or how she will pay. The determination of the total amount owed by Germany is left to the discretion of the Permanent Conference for Reparations. The conference will fix the amount, whatever its total may be, without considering Germany's ability to pay. Thus, the conference's decision would be final and binding. Would Germany be in a position to pay? This was never on the conference's agenda. However, provision had been made in the event Germany failed to pay on time, Germany would be invaded. The Huns, as the Germans were called by the British and American press, had never been consulted during the entire duration of the Paris Peace Conference, despite Wilson's solemn undertaking that they would be. The German High Command was never received by its Allied counterpart. The decisions of the Peace Conference were communicated to Germany only after they had been agreed upon by the Allies, just like a judge reading a death sentence, except that generally speaking a judicial decision would have been reached by due process of law, with attorneys representing the accused and with the appearance of witnesses. In the case of the Peace Conference, the accused was never allowed to show his face, nor was anyone allowed to offer any form of defense. All accusations made were accepted as facts. Even at an Inquisition trial, the alleged heretic, with a hood over his head, was allowed to be present during all public proceedings. In Paris, there was neither hood nor debate. A condemnatory text was handed over to the guilty Germans. Count Brockdorff, the German representative, was shocked, and the Allied Commission would not specify the amount Germany would have to pay in reparations. The Allies had a blank check, and even a German offer to double what Keynes had proposed was received negatively. This represented 100 billion gold marks, which was 25 times more than the Germans had imposed on France after the 1870-71 Franco-Prussian War. In that instance, Germany had invaded France and unequivocally won the war. In 1918, at the time of the armistice, the Allies had not succeeded in setting a toe on German soil. On the contrary, Marshal von Hindenburg and the German troops were in control of Belgian and French soil. The Germans had laid down their arms because they believed the terms formulated by Wilson. The Allies had broken Wilson's word. Now, after numerous frauds and betrayals, Germany was reduced to begging the Allies to name the price of its punishment. The Allies had not only not decided on an amount, but also did not know how this multi-billion dollar reparation was going to be divided. Lloyd George proposed, after much debate, "I suggest France receive 50% of whatever Germany will pay, Great Britain receive 30% and the other countries 20%. This proportion will give France a marked preference. But I could not, before British opinion, go below the proportion that I reserve for Great Britain." This proposal triggered furious haggling. The British, who had helped themselves so generously before the treaty, could afford to be generous with an intangible percentage of chimerical billions. Tardieu, blinded with hatred and greed, balked at Lloyd George's suggestion. He dispatched his finance minister, Loucheur, to the attack. Loucheur declared this proposal unacceptable. He reminded them that France had already consented to a compromise by no longer talking about priorities. His final acceptance would be 56% for France and 25% for Great Britain. Peace, page 388. This sort of haggling, more worthy of an Oriental bazaar than of the leaders of civilized Western nations, would continue for months. The Allies and their clients were all clamoring to increase their percentage of Germany's hide. The government of Australia was wailing it had lost more men than the United States and was therefore entitled to more money. Had Australia asserted its alleged sovereignty and declined to fight Britain's war, the question would not have arisen. New Zealand was likewise demanding money for lost men. Lloyd George put in a good word for them, "I am asking you to think of these brave little nations." Finally, Tardieu settled for 55% and Lloyd George for 25%, after hundreds of hours of acrimonious dickering, all for a few percentage points. Tardieu had compromised little, since the treaty did not even include his claim for damages in the percentages. "This percentage does not include our loss of livestock, equipment and property." Tardieu and Clemenceau rejected out of hand Germany's offer of $25 billion because they wanted reparations that would keep Germany in a permanent state of inferiority, just as they had led their electorate to believe. Alan Abbott Young, an American delegate at Versailles, explained, "The discussions were essentially political and their effects rather distant. What mattered in these talks on the economic state of Germany was the immediate effect they had on the press, the French Assembly, and the French electorate." What happened in Paris, page 232. Clemenceau had two considerations: being elected president of France and keeping Germany down by any means. His intransigence led to the resignation of both Count Brockdorff and John Maynard Keynes. Klotz, the Jewish cabinet member, regarded the sum of $25 billion as merely a deposit, the first of many. "This figure is only a deposit on the total debt to be paid in yearly installments until 1988. Although how much was to be paid yearly was not mentioned, Klotz warned it would not be less than $200 billion in gold. Thus, for 70 years successive generations of Germans were expected to slave away to satisfy Klotz and his banker patrons. The Permanent Conference on Reparations established a repayment plan whereby Germany would issue 100 billion gold marks worth of bonds as initial payment. The conference was empowered to change the amount any time it wanted, and would be free to enforce collection in any way it chose. The conference will make decisions without being bound by any regulations, code, rule or legislation. Its authority is recognized by Germany under the treaty. Its essential obligation will be to control Germany's economy, its financial operations, its assets, its production capacity, now and in the future. The conference's decision will be executed forthwith, without any other formality. It will be empowered to change any German laws it sees fit and impose any financial, economic or military sanction in case of Germany's non-compliance with its rules. Germany undertakes in advance not to consider such sanctions, whatever they may be, as acts of hostility." Tardieu, Peace, page 350-351. Thus the conference, backed by powerful banking interests, had absolute power of life and death over Germany, not unlike the way the same banking interests exert power over the world's nations today. They decide when austerity, devaluation, recessions, depressions or change of policy will take place, as well as sanctions for recalcitrants. Keynes summed up the powers of the conference: "It is the arbiter of Germany's economic life, deciding its imports of food and raw material, its taxes, etc. Germany is no longer a people or state. It has become a commercial establishment placed under the control of a revenue agent by its creditors. The conference, which will be headquartered outside Germany, will have far more power than the Kaiser ever had. Under such a regime, the German people will be stripped for years of all rights and private property far more completely than any nation in the days of absolutism. They will be stripped of freedom of action, or all individual progress, whether economic or even moral." Of this de facto government of Germany located in Paris, Clemenceau said, "The situation brought about by the treaty is going to develop and we are going to benefit from it." Besides controlling Germany's economy and politics, Clemenceau wanted to control Germany militarily for many years to come. His Allied colleagues disagreed strongly on this point. They saw no point in occupying Germany as long as reparations were being made. Furthermore, people in most of the Allied countries had tired of war, and it had become politically unwise for the politicians to maintain troops away from home once the peace treaty had been signed. Clemenceau had more in mind than securing reparations, and he rejected Germany's offer of $25 billion. He wanted the eventual detachment of the Rhineland from Germany, which he envisaged as occurring after a prolonged military occupation. The intrigues of General Mangin to this end almost destroyed Clemenceau's long-range plans. However, Clemenceau wore everybody down at the conference, and it was reluctantly agreed to let the Rhineland occupation stand. Shrewdly, he had appeared to compromise by letting the commission decide the fate of Germany and the collection of reparations, but he had extracted in exchange the appointment of one of his men as president of the conference. Since all decisions had to be unanimous, Clemenceau was indirectly given veto power over the conference's decisions. The naive may have believed that Wilson's 14 points, which the Germans and the Allies had agreed on as the basis of the peace treaty, would serve as the basis of a new age, one without annexations or exactions. That was an illusion. The Allies' agreement was worth nothing. It was merely a subterfuge to disarm Germany in order to pursue a policy of gain, greed, and vengeance. The Allies had won a war by trickery, one which they had started by an institutionalized policy of mercantile voracity. There was not the slightest thread of principles or idealism in any of their actions. Bankers, financiers, masons, communists, and Jews were the benefactors in this massive bloodletting. Millions upon millions went to their deaths whipped up by a patriotism cynically manufactured by the financial leadership and its henchmen.